aroma of the M&Ms and explained how she usually approached the candy. "First I'll eat just a few, not a lot, then I'll have a few more, and I'll keep doing that until I feel sick." Trying to compensate, Rosalita drinks plenty of water and makes it a point to eat a vegetable. She's an old hand at that sort of strategy. The Snickers bar didn't appeal to her because it looked too big, and she knew eating it would make her feel guilty. Instead, she tends to reach for small sweets, like bite-sized pieces of candy. And when a colleague brings in cookies, I'll eat one, go to my desk, and think about them. Then I'll go back for another one, and I'll do that for the rest of the afternoon. Rosalita almost never feels physically full. She never leaves food on her plate. When food is around, she thinks about it constantly, but she has developed techniques that allow her to keep her weight in check. Although Jacob is also partial to peanut butter M&Ms, he doesn't necessarily need to eat them. "I'm full," he said, looking at the open bag. "I already had a cookie about an hour and a half ago. They don't interest me." He likes sweets, he explained, but had no desire to eat them when he wasn't hungry. They just don't seem appealing. Jacob eats mostly for fuel. "I just want to get eating out of the way," he says. He rarely gives much thought to food. Claudia and Maria couldn't understand his attitude. Seeing the strong response that highly palatable foods can generate helped me understand why the settling point gets pushed up in the face of reward. No one in the group had even eaten the snacks on the table, yet their presence was enough to make some people feel less in control. Claudia, Maria, and Rosalita do not fit any of the formal criteria for disordered eating. They don't, for example, behave like a woman who could not pass by a pastry shop without devouring 15 cakes, one of the first cases of binge eating to be described in research papers. They are not binge eaters who will eat huge quantities of food in short periods of time. They don't purge after they eat excessively. They don't exhibit the psychological problems, such as depression, that are often associated with eating disorders. But they feel powerless in the face of certain foods. This may be the primary characteristic of what is sometimes referred to as emotional or compulsive eating, although there are no formal definitions of these terms. Their behavior is best understood as a reward-driven response to the sensory stimuli associated with food. This response isn't exclusive to overweight people. Many thin people have the same impulse. It's just that, like Rosalita, they found ways to maintain control. The capacity of food to acquire a powerful salience or prominence in the human mind is strong. How do inanimate objects, M&Ms, Charlie cookies, cake rolls, acquire such power over us? What allows them to so thoroughly dominate our attention? How do these foods spin so many of us out of control?
Chapter 6. Sugar, fat, and salt are reinforcing.
Rewarding foods tend to be reinforcing, meaning that they keep us coming back for more. I put an M&M in my mouth, it tastes good, and I return for another. The sugar and fat in the candy reinforce my desire to keep eating it. Scientists ask two questions to determine whether animals find a substance reinforcing. Are they willing to work to obtain it? Do they respond to other stimuli they've learned to associate with the substance? By these criteria, sugar, fat, and salt are clearly reinforcing. One decisive piece of evidence is exquisitely simple. French researchers first allowed one group of animals to eat freely while restricting the diet of another group. Next, they measured the speed at which each group ran for chow compared to Chalk and Crisp, a German chocolate-flavored cereal high in sugar and fat. It was no surprise that the hungry animals ran faster toward chow than animals that had been allowed to feed freely. But hunger did not influence the appeal of Chalk and Crisp. Both groups headed toward the cereal at almost the same speed. We once thought that in the absence of hunger, food could not serve as an effective reward. That idea proved to be wrong. As the French experiment demonstrates, animals will work for foods that are high in sugar and fat, even if they're not hungry. They'll also work for salt solutions, especially if they've ever been salt depleted. Another persuasive study demonstrated that animals will work for high sugar foods. That research, conducted at Carleton University in Ottawa, Ontario, used a progressive ratio technique that forces rats to work harder and harder to obtain their next reward. At the beginning of the study, getting a reward was easy. When an animal pressed a lever once, it earned its first reward. The second reward came after 3 presses of the lever. Next, 6 lever presses were required. A 4th reward took 10 lever presses, a 5th took 16, and a 6th took 23 presses of the lever. Researchers look for the breaking point, the point beyond which the animal will not keep pressing the lever in search of a reward. In the Canadian study, rats generally worked harder, that is, they pressed the lever more, to get higher concentrations of sucrose. On average, they pressed enough to earn 5 rewards of a solution without sucrose, about 6 rewards of a 10% sucrose solution, and about 8 rewards of the 20% solution. To get that 8th reward of 20% sucrose, a rat had to press the lever 44 times. Interestingly, this study also showed that there's a limit to how sweet animals like their solutions. They worked less at a sucrose concentration of 30%, pressing the lever only enough to earn, on average, just under 7 rewards. Like people, they have a sucrose bliss point, although, at least in this study, it seemed to be higher than ours. There's still plenty of work in pursuit of reward and a clear demonstration of the reinforcing qualities of sugar. Foods high in fat get similar results. Using mice as test animals when she was at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Sarah Ward would measure the willingness of animals to work for a corn oil solution even when they were not hungry. She also used a progressive ratio, allowing an animal to earn a reward after poking its nose into a hole a certain number of times. A 10% corn oil solution had the greatest reinforcing properties, with the breaking point occurring after slightly more than 12 rewards. It took her animals just over 50 nose pokes to earn that reward. Fat, too, is a reinforcer, with a reward value that stimulates an animal to work. Animals are willing to work even harder for foods that are high in sugar and fat. Ward used Ensure, a liquid nutritional drink that contains both, to conduct another nose-poke experiment. Adopting the same progressive ratio she'd applied to corn oil, she found that mice worked enough in an hour to earn approximately 14 rewards, the last one requiring 77 nose pokes. This is scientific confirmation that the combination of fat and sugar is a strong reinforcer. In a conversation with Ward, I asked her how strong it really was. The breaking point at which animals will no longer work for the reward, she told me, is slightly lower than the breaking point for cocaine. Animals are willing to work almost as hard to get either one. My own look at a vanilla milkshake confirmed the reinforcing value of sugar and fat and helped me better understand what matters most. Working with colleagues at the University of Washington and Western Washington University, who are experts at determining which qualities in a substance motivate us to pursue it, we were able to determine that in products combining sugar, fat, and flavoring, sugar exerts the greatest influence. Fat is also reinforcing, but calorie for calorie, sucrose is the dominant factor. The power of the vanilla milkshake and other high-sugar, high-fat foods is further amplified as cues become associated with them. Along with taste and other sensory characteristics, the location where the food has previously been available and the events associated with past consumption can also become reinforcers. In time, these cues become as important in food-seeking behavior as the food itself. A bowl of M&Ms, for example, can be reinforcing before I touch a single one. If I've eaten the candy in the past, I'm stimulated by the sight of it because I know it will be rewarding. I reach for an M&M, eat it, and experience that reward. The visual cue gains power. Cues associated with the pleasure response demand our attention, motivate our behavior, and stimulate the urge we call wanting. When those cues are present, we learn to pursue food with greater vigor to secure the expected reward. With experience, the association between cues and food becomes even stronger, and we become more single-minded in our focus and our pursuit. That increases consumption. We pursue the food more frequently, and the resulting pleasure leads us to repeat the behavior. A continuous cycle of cue, urge, reward is set in motion and eventually becomes a habit. The conditioned place paradigm is a time-tested scientific technique for assessing the reinforcing properties of one particular cue, location. The stage is set when a desired substance is given to an animal in a certain location. We then compare the animal's preference for being in that location after the desired substance is removed to its preference for being someplace similar where the substance has never appeared. A substantial body of scientific literature has accumulated over the years to show that animals become conditioned to prefer environments where opiates, amphetamines, morphine, and other drugs were previously available. More recently, some scientists have turned their attention to the question of whether certain foods can also generate a conditioned place preference. One study examined how animals learn to associate snack foods with location. The experiment began with a test to determine which of two chambers of a cage a rat preferred, measured by how much time it spent there. No food was provided in either chamber. The animals, which were not hungry at the time of the experiments, were then divided into two groups. The first was given Fruit Loops in its less favored chamber. The second group was fed standard chow in the chamber it preferred. Next, the second group was offered Cheetos, a high-calorie, high-fat snack food in its less preferred chamber, while the first group got standard chow in its preferred locale. Both groups of animals spent more time in their less preferred chamber, presumably motivated by the opportunity to consume either Fruit Loops or Cheetos. Then the initial chamber preference test was repeated. Again, the rats were free to choose their locale, and again there was no food in either chamber. The findings were clear. Regardless of their previous choices, both groups of rats had learned to prefer the chamber where they'd eaten either Fruit Loops or Cheetos. Their exposure to foods high in sugar or fat had conditioned them to prefer the place where that exposure had occurred. For humans, too, location is one of the most potent cues. Pass the mall where you know you'll find a Ruby Tuesday, or the neighborhood where your town's best pizza's available, and you'll experience a desire that you didn't have a moment before. Evidence that high-sugar, high-fat foods are reinforcing, then, comes from two key findings in animal studies. Animals are willing to work harder for those foods, and the foods intensify the power of cues, such as where the animal once encountered the stimuli. Three other features of food also exert a powerful influence on our desire for more. First, quantity. Give a rat two pellets of food rather than one, give a person two scoops of ice cream rather than one, and they'll eat more. Portion size matters. Second is the concentration of rewarding ingredients. Adding more sugar or fat to a given portion boosts its desirability, although only up to a point. In excess, either one can lessen its appeal. Finally, variety plays an important role. We saw this when Anthony Sclafani demonstrated that a supermarket diet can throw off the body's system of energy balance, but providing access to different kinds of foods is only one way to increase stimulation. We can also add features to the environment in which a food is served, associating it with an external signal, such as light or sound. Or we can load in sensory inputs, such as adding chocolate chips to ice cream. Another way to achieve variety is with what's called dynamic contrast. The Oreo cookie, with its combination of flavors and textures, bitter chocolate wafer, sweet cream filling, is a classic example of a food with dynamic contrast. Sugar and fat are reinforcing, and cues, quantity, concentration, and variety all increase that reinforcement value. That still doesn't mean everyone will go after these foods with equal effort. Some people are likelier than others to find food more reinforcing and are thus willing to work harder to obtain it. What the evidence tells us is that sugar and fat, as well as the cues predicting that sugar and fat are available, can condition the behavior of those who are vulnerable.
Chapter 7. amping up the neurons.
When we put food rich in sugar, fat, and salt in our mouths, we stimulate neurons, which are the basic cells of the brain. Neurons are connected in circuits and communicate with one another to create feelings, store information, and control behavior. They respond to rewarding foods by firing electrical signals and releasing brain chemicals that then travel to interconnected neurons. We say those neurons are encoded for palatability. What does it mean for a neuron to encode? I asked Howard Fields, a professor of neurology and physiology at the University of California, San Francisco. If a neuron encodes the color red, it will fire more when a red light is showing than when any other color is showing, said Fields. Encoding means that the neuron shows a preference by firing more. A small proportion of neurons are uniquely encoded to respond to a single sensory characteristic of food. For example, one neuron may respond only to taste, another only to texture. Others may be stimulated exclusively by the sight, smell, or temperature of food. Certain neurons are even more specific. Some are particularly responsive to sweet, salty, sour, or bitter tastes. Neurons encoded for sucrose respond vigorously to sweeter foods. The sweeter the sucrose solution, the more those neurons fire, Fields explained. The more these neurons fire, the more sucrose the rat will consume. We also know that artificial sweeteners can generate the same effect. There are, in addition, neurons that respond to specific combinations of sensory inputs. A single cell can be tuned to a whole set of different sensory oral attributes, said Edmund Rolls, professor of experimental psychology at Oxford University in England. Using functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, technology, Rolls has created images of how the brain responds when it's stimulated. His work allows us to see specific neural circuits in action. For example, a neuron stimulated by a sweet taste that's been coupled with a fatty texture would be active when we eat, say, an eclair. A single food can also stimulate many different neurons simultaneously. One set of neurons may fire at its sugary taste, while another fires in response to its creamy texture, and still another is provoked by its aroma. The cumulative effect of all this is that sensory stimuli amp up the neurons, getting them to fire more. The message to eat becomes stronger, motivating the eater to act more vigorously in pursuit of the stimulus. The most dominant source of the power of highly palatable foods comes from just one of the senses, taste. Although the sight and smell of food, as well as other sensory stimulants, enhance food's appeal and motivate us to eat, taste has by far the most direct connection to the body's reward system. Alone among the senses, taste is hardwired to brain cells that respond to pleasure. It prompts the strongest emotional response. Gerard Smith, a pioneer in the study of ingestive behavior at New York Presbyterian Hospital, coined the term orosensory self-stimulation to refer to a cyclical process in which eating delicious foods tells the brain to make us want more of those foods. The reinforcing properties of food are lodged primarily in their capacity to stimulate the taste apparatus. Whatever we say about preference or liking or salience refers primarily to food's orosensory properties, said Smith. If you're talking about the things that drive eating or make food more appetizing, you're always talking about orosensory effects. The neurons in the brain that are stimulated by taste and other properties of highly palatable food are part of the opioid circuitry, which is the body's primary pleasure system. The opioids, also known as endorphins, are chemicals produced in the brain that have rewarding effects similar to drugs such as morphine and heroin. Stimulating the opioid circuitry with food drives us to eat. When we first put a highly palatable food into our mouths, taste buds in the tongue respond by sending a signal to an area of the lower brain responsible for controlling many of our involuntary activities, such as breathing and digestion. When the lower brain receives that signal, it activates the neural circuitry that contains natural opioid molecules. Whether the opioid circuits are activated by highly palatable foods or by drugs, they enable the body to perceive a rewarding experience. Responding unconsciously, an animal may move its jaw and tongue, and an infant may smile. Awareness of pleasure is a higher brain function, as is the record of the experiences associated with it. From the lower brain, the sensory experience of taste travels through the midbrain, reaching regions where the sensory signals of food are integrated. Those signals are ultimately relayed to the nucleus accumbens, an area of the brain that is a center of reward. In addition to their stimulating effects, the opioids produced by eating high-sugar, high-fat foods can relieve pain or stress and calm us down. At least in the short run, they make us feel better. We see this in infants who cry less when given sugar water. We can also observe that animals feel less pain when they're administered opioid-like drugs, and even less when they're allowed unrestricted access to sucrose at the same time. In a cyclical process, eating highly palatable food activates the opioid circuits, and activating these circuits increases consumption of highly palatable food. This is evident in studies demonstrating that animals eat more high-sugar, high-fat foods after receiving an opioid injection. We also know that after using drugs that stimulate the opioid circuitry, people report that palatable food is more pleasant and they eat more of it. The power of opioids to stimulate us, calm us down, and give us pleasure has been made concrete by scientific advances that allow us to detect associated molecular changes in the circuits of the brain. For example, we can see that the molecular machinery that produces opioids within the body changes after chronic exposure to chocolate Ensure. Engaging the opioid mechanisms can also interfere with a phenomenon known as taste-specific satiety. After eating a certain amount of one food, animals typically become satisfied with its taste and stop eating it, but they'll keep on eating if something else is available. When palatable foods stimulate the opioid circuits, that pattern changes. Josh Woolley, a neuroscientist at the University of California, San Francisco, demonstrated this with chocolate and banana-flavored food pellets called Supreme Mini Treats, which consist primarily of sucrose and fat. He first allowed his test animals to eat as much chocolate as they wanted for an hour. Then he gave them 90 minutes of unrestricted access to both banana and chocolate, and he observed that the animals chose to eat significantly more banana. Apparently, their initial exposure to chocolate had reduced but not eliminated further interest in that flavor, but left them enough appetite for the novel taste of banana. The same thing happened in reverse. When exposed first to banana, an animal later ate more chocolate when given a choice of flavors. Something very different happened in the next phase, when Woolley injected opioids into the brains of his animals after exposing them to either the chocolate or banana pellets. Now, the initial flavor was the one they continued to prefer. Stimulating the opioid circuitry overcame the natural tendency for taste-specific satiety. They didn't grow tired of it. Another way to demonstrate the role of the opioid circuitry is to block the production of opioids and watch the results. One set of experiments is done with a class of drugs known as opioid antagonists, such as naltrexone and naloxone. Typically, these are used to treat human dependence on morphine and heroin because they negate the pleasure that people otherwise derive from those substances. Scientists also use opioid antagonists to learn more about the influence of the body's opioids on eating behavior. For example, Josh Woolley found that animals ate less chocolate after they were injected with naltrexone, presumably because blocking the opioid signals took away its reward value. Other researchers have demonstrated that opioid antagonists shorten the length of a meal. In one study, animals that were fed a high sucrose meal initially ate for a longer period of time than those fed a cornstarch diet. No surprise there. But the picture changed when naloxone was administered. Both groups of animals ate less, but the effect was more dramatic among the sucrose-fed rats. Interfering with opioids had the strongest effect on the food the animals preferred. For all its influence over our behavior, the wellspring of pleasure in the brain is not very large. scientists have mapped the web of opioid circuits that make up the pleasure center and can take pictures as it lights up in response to the taste of sugar, fat, and salt. One small region lies at the center of all that pleasure. Kent Berridge at the University of Michigan has called this the hedonic hotspot. He believes that stimulating that hotspot, just one cubic millimeter, about the size of the head of a pin in the nucleus accumbens, causes us to like something, really like something. The hotspot seems to actually magnify, to causally enhance the pleasure of the taste, said Berridge. It lays an extra pleasure gloss onto the taste sensation.
Chapter 8. We are wired to focus attention on the most salient stimuli.
Eating and the desire to eat need to be understood as separate activities involving separate mechanisms in the brain. Their distinct roles help us understand another brain chemical, dopamine. If opioids give food its pleasure and help keep us eating, dopamine motivates our behavior and impels us toward food. By strengthening our sense of anticipation, dopamine gets us to engage in a complex set of pursuit and acquisition behaviors so we can recapture the remembered pleasure of a favored food. Dopamine drives desire through a survival-based capacity known as attentional bias, defined as the exaggerated amount of attention that is paid to highly rewarding stimuli at the expense of other, neutral stimuli. Attentional bias allows us to pick out what matters most so we can pursue it. It gives rewarding foods their prominence in our minds. The more rewarding the food, the greater the attention we direct toward it, and the more vigorously we pursue it. John Salamone, a professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Connecticut, was a graduate student when he first noticed that hungry animals became extremely hyperactive when offered food pellets. In fact, they behaved like animals that had been treated with amphetamines. Salamone also noticed that blocking dopamine with an antagonist drug damped down that frenzied activity considerably. He went on to study how hard animals with normal levels of dopamine will work to obtain food rewards compared to those with depleted dopamine levels. Salamone's research team placed four tasty food pellets at one end of the top of a T-shaped maze and two pellets at the other end. The rats learned where the larger portion of food was available, and when they reached the T-intersection, they consistently turned toward the larger food portion. When investigators depleted the rats' dopamine levels, the animals slowed their movement toward food, but still maneuvered their way to the four pellets. Salamone's next step was to erect an 18-inch barrier that made access to the four-pellet side harder. A lot of training was required before animals with normal levels of dopamine were able to do the considerable work necessary to overcome that obstacle and reach the food. Watching them scale the barrier was a bit like watching Richard Gere master the obstacle course in An Officer and a Gentleman, Salamone said. The rats get a running start. They leap to the top of the barrier, they grab it and fling themselves over, and then they go down the other side and they eat their four pellets. From an evolutionary perspective, that effort made sense. Dopamine is involved in the activational aspects of foraging behavior, Salamone explained, and this is very important for survival, because a part of survival is being able to expend enough energy and be active enough to gain access to the stimuli that are necessary. Dopamine-depleted animals behaved differently. They were unwilling to work hard enough to overcome the barrier. Instead, they settled for the easier option, turning to the unobstructed side of the maze to reach the two pellets. While dopamine increases an animal's ability to work, its activities are carefully targeted. The release of dopamine in the presence of the most salient stimuli guides an animal to act with appropriate vigor to pursue the greatest reward. The capacity to filter out lesser background noise is essential to that process. Howard Fields described a study in which animals chose between two chambers, each holding a sweet solution. The study animals were first given the option of licking either plain water or a 3% sucrose solution. Then they had a choice between that 3% sucrose mixture in one chamber and a more concentrated 10% sucrose solution in the other. In both instances, they preferred the relatively sweeter option, showing that a 4% solution was good enough when the alternative wasn't sweet at all, but was less attractive if something even sweeter was available. The neurons in the brain's nucleus accumbens encoded that preference, firing more dopamine for the most highly concentrated solution. Animals, humans included, seem to have a built-in preference for features larger than those that occur naturally. Ethologists, scientists who study animal behavior, have tried to understand the attraction of supernormal stimuli. Consider the oyster catcher, a shorebird with black and white plumage, a red bill, and brightly colored legs. Back in the 1950s, Dutch ethologist Nicholas Tinbergen conducted now classic studies of the bird's incubation behavior and discovered something astonishing. When presented with a choice between brooding its own small egg and the giant egg of a much larger bird, the oyster catcher invariably chose to sit on the giant one. Research with the herring gull and the gray-lag goose uncovered much the same thing. Both of these birds prefer an egg that is biologically impossible for them to have laid. We also see this with butterflies. When a male is courting, he'll be drawn to the female by the rate at which she flickers her wings. But when a butterfly is presented with some kind of artificial stimuli that flickers even faster, that's what he'll prefer. Most of the relevant research about supernormal stimuli was conducted decades ago, although some contemporary writers and scientists have taken on the topic as it relates to food in recent years as well. I wanted to talk to one of the original researchers in the field, John Staden. Now a professor of biology and neurobiology at Duke University, seems startled to be tracked down as an expert on the subject. "I wrote some stuff on this years and years ago," he told me, surprised that I had uncovered his work. His early findings seemed to deserve new scrutiny as I considered the possible analogies to food. Staden and I talked about the concept of asymmetrical selection pressure. From the standpoint of evolution, a bird's preference for a larger egg over a smaller one makes sense. Smaller eggs are more likely to be non-viable, so birds that consistently choose them would not have been likely to survive as a species. Their preference for a giant egg is a logical extension of a preference for the egg that seems most likely to be viable. I asked Staden about the kind of food we eat today. "Now I'm eating very energy-dense sugar and fat," I said, "and I've artificially created it. It didn't exist in the wild. Is it a supernormal stimulus?" "It would be," said Staden. "It's not only exaggerated, it also has never been seen in nature. Those features define the term." "Why do I prefer an exaggerated stimulus?" I asked. "Your ancestors were punished for preferring a smaller-than-normal stimulus, but not punished for preferring a larger-than-normal stimulus," explained Staden, hearkening back to asymmetrical selection pressure. He talked about the gradient of preference established by evolution. Whether it's a gigantic egg or a hyper-palatable food, a lot seems to be more desirable than a little. An entertainment spectacle such as Disneyland or Las Vegas attracts us in much the same way. Today's choices only push us further along that gradient. In the selection pressures acting on the species, more sugar was always better than less, said Staden. The amount of sugar in food today goes beyond the level we could have experienced naturally, and that just means we desire it all the more.
Chapter 9. Rewarding Foods Become Hot Stimuli.
On a scientific level, I already understood that salient foods focus our attention and that dopamine promotes the approach behavior that brings us to them. I also understood this on a personal level through my enthusiasm for chocolate frozen yogurt with sprinkles and cookie dough. Not so many decades ago, a single flavor of store-bought ice cream was a special treat. Our options ran to vanilla, chocolate, and strawberry. And when we could buy all three flavors in a single carton, we saw that as a great innovation. Over time, many more flavors became available, and then specialty ice cream stores opened, serving premium, higher-fat ice cream. In the 1970s, Steve's Ice Cream was the most famous ice cream parlor in the Boston area, earning its reputation for long lines of fans by mixing smoosh-ins, Heath bars, Reese's peanut butter cups, and other confections, into a scoop of ice cream. Then a novelty, now it's entirely commonplace. The food industry has certainly figured out what captures consumer awareness. Today, of course, ice cream has countless flavors and varieties, and so do most other foods. Once, there were just a few kinds of hot, fresh bagels. We could buy a plain bagel, or one with sesame or poppy seeds. Now, bagels come flavored with onions, garlic, cinnamon and raisins, blueberries and chocolate. The Panera bread chain goes further, offering the cherry vanilla bagel, the Asiago cheese bagel, the French toast bagel, and the Dutch apple and raisin bagel. Each one comes loaded with sugar, on fat, on salt. Mike McLeod of Uptown Bakers, an artisanal wholesale bakery based in Maryland, called these tricked-out bagels. You take a basic concept like a bagel, which is a very clean bakery item, to appeal to a different market segment, you trick it out, McLeod said. You add ingredients to change the mouthfeel and the texture. You put jalapenos and corn kernels in it and call it a Southwestern bagel. My son says that Panera's Cinnamon Crunch Bagel is the best he's ever eaten. It's the restaurant's top seller, so that's what I decided to try. I read the list of ingredients first. After unbleached flour and water, the bagel contained both vanilla drops, which include sugar and partially hydrogenated palm kernel oil, and cinnamon drops, with sugar and palm oil. Other ingredients included brown sugar, honey, vanilla, salt, molasses, and more palm oil, topped with sugar, cinnamon, and soybean oil. Taking my first bite, I concentrated on the sensory hits it provided. The topping gave the bagel a crunchy sweetness, which contrasts nicely with the soft interior. The aroma of cinnamon was pleasant and persistent, and the vanilla chips offered appealing bursts of flavor. As I chewed, the bagel was quickly transformed into a moist wad in my mouth, with the crunch becoming finer as it dissolved. It was easy to chew and to swallow, and its sweetness lingered yet didn't overwhelm the other flavors. Well lubricated by its fat content and mixed with my saliva, the wad of bagel melted perfectly in my mouth, disappearing after only a few chews. The Cinnamon Crunch Bagel was manufactured to perfection. Panera had figured out how to put fat, sugar, and other flavor enhancements together to provide exactly the sensory experience I wanted. Armed with a deeper understanding of how the human brain is wired to focus attention on the most salient stimuli, you may listen differently to the following television advertisement sponsored by TGI Fridays, the chain restaurant designed to be the ultimate food carnival. It goes like this. This isn't about grabbing a bite. It's about a bite grabbing you. Because when Fridays gets a hold of your appetite, we're not letting go. We are going to bring on the flavor till your taste buds explode like fireworks. We're going to dribble glazes and pour on smoky sauces. We're going to pan fry, saute, and dream up new dishes that have never been created before. Three courses, new tastes. This is an apt description of how a food becomes salient and how we respond. One appetizer, the Parmesan-crusted Sicilian quesadilla, is described on the menu as follows. Packed with sautéed chicken, sausage, bruschetta marinara, and bacon, and oozing with Monterey Jack cheese, we coat it with Parmesan and pan-fry it to a crispy golden brown, then drizzle it with balsamic glaze. Dessert is equally multisensory. Chocolate peanut butter pie topped with whipped cream and a Reese's peanut butter cup. Or Chips Ahoy ice cream sundae, topped with Chips Ahoy cookie crumbles, hot fudge, caramel sauce, and whipped cream. No one has studied the effects of the TGI Fridays quesadilla or Panera's Cinnamon Crunch Bagel on dopamine, but it's not a drastic leap to suggest that they have the same effect as other combinations of stimulating ingredients. Chocolate, with its high fat content and sucrose, increased dopamine levels in animals that have eaten recently enough not to be hungry. Combine sucrose and alcohol, and we see the same multisensory effect. And there is even more arousal when we combine all three stimulants. An animal that eats a combination of sucrose, chocolate, and alcohol releases the greatest levels of dopamine. When layer upon layer of complexity is built into food, the effect becomes more powerful. Sweetness alone does not account for the full impact of a soda. Its temperature and tingle, which results from the stimulation of the trigeminal nerve by carbonation and acid, are essential contributors as well. The complexity of the stimulus increases its association to a reward, said Gaetano Di Chiara, an expert in neuroscience and pharmacology at the University of Cagliari in Italy. Elements of that complexity include tastes that are familiar and well-liked, especially if they aren't always readily available, a multitude of sensory inputs, and the learning associated with having had a pleasurable experience with the same food in the past. We have discovered that increasing the multisensory aspects of a stimulus, or adding other compatible stimuli, can strengthen the reinforcing effect. The more potent and multisensory foods become, the greater the rewards they may offer, and the more we learn to work for them. Much of the excitement takes place in the orbitofrontal cortex, the brain region where neurons fire in response to rewarding foods. The more someone wants to eat highly palatable food, the more activity we see in the orbitofrontal cortex. The excitement in the brain generated by these multimodal stimuli increases our desire for further stimulation. This is not the kind of language the food industry likes to use in its advertisements, but the science helps us understand what happens when we walk into many of America's most popular restaurants. It explains how foods become hot stimuli.
Chapter 10. Cues activate brain circuits that guide behavior.
Activity in the brain is stimulated not only by food itself, but also by cues suggesting that food is nearby. First, we have to learn through experience that a cue is linked to a specific food. Once this happens, the signal that predicts the food, rather than the food itself, generates the dopamine response. This signal then becomes the trigger of desire. We call this a conditioned stimulus. The cues grip us, arousing us to act. Every high school student knows the story of Pavlov and his dogs. In the late 19th century, Russian scientist Ivan Petrovich Pavlov began studying the reflexive responses of his animals. His enduring contribution was to demonstrate that if he rang a bell at the same time he fed his dogs, the animals would learn to associate the sound of that bell with food. Eventually, the animals would secrete saliva and drool at the sound of the bell, even when it wasn't accompanied by food. The bell became a conditioned stimulus, generating a predictable response. Conditioning can happen quickly. In one study, people were given a high-sugar, high-fat snack for 5 consecutive mornings. For days afterwards, they wanted something sweet at about the same time each morning that they had been fed the snack, even though they had not previously snacked at that time. Desire had already taken hold. Wolfram Schultz, a professor of neuroscience at the University of Cambridge, is among contemporary scientists who have built on Pavlov's seminal finding in their studies of dopamine. Schultz is interested in the cause and timing of spikes in dopamine activity. An animal releases dopamine in a steady and fairly consistent pattern when it is not being stimulated. But give an animal a reward, and transient bursts of increased dopamine can be detected in its brain. By implanting electrodes in the nucleus accumbens of an animal, Schultz was able to record the timing and level of that dopamine release. In an experiment, he looked at what happened when monkeys were given a reward they didn't expect, a taste of sweet juice. There was an upward spike in their dopamine levels. Next, he gave the monkeys a visual or auditory cue, followed almost immediately by the same juice. Once they became familiar with that sequence of events, their patterns of dopamine firing changed. Based on learned experience, the animals began to recognize the cue as a signal that the juice was coming and responded with elevated dopamine activity. Rather than firing at the reward itself, dopamine fired in response to the stimulus that predicted the reward. Given dopamine's role in focusing attention, the pairing of a cue with a reward had a potent effect on behavior. When Regina Corelli, A professor of psychology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill measured electrical activity in the brain of a rat. She saw something similar. Milliseconds after the animal received a cue it had learned to associate with palatable food, several subsets of neurons responded to the conditioned stimulus by firing robustly. When the cue did not predict a food reward, the brain responded very differently, with some neurons exhibiting a much smaller response and others showing almost no activity at all. The contrast was clear. Cues that are associated with rewards turn on electrical activity in the brain. Incentive salience, a term coined by Kent Berridge, helps explain what's going on. Simply put, incentive salience is the desire, activated by cues, for something that predicts reward. It's a learned association. We learn to want a food or some other substance we once liked. We may no longer like that food, although often we do. But it's the wanting, not the liking, that drives us to do the work necessary to obtain that food. Cue-induced wanting, said Berridge, is triggered by the sight of a cookie, or someone lighting up a cigarette nearby, or clinking the ice cubes in the glass of alcohol. Those kinds of cues have the power to evoke the desire to take that thing again. Experience imbues the cue with incentive salience. Positive emotions become embedded in cues, which then develop a force of their own. We've already seen some kinds of cues. Animal studies often use a light or a tone. For humans, visual cues include not only the sight of food, but the sight of a restaurant where we once ate that food, the street corner we pass en route, or a billboard advertising that restaurant. Sounds and smells, as well as attributes such as time of day and location, can assume the same stimulating power. So too can the people and the moods, both positive and negative, that were once associated with a stimulus. The aroma of a cherry pie can evoke your grandmother's home-cooked meals, creating desire. Driven by dopamine, these cues motivate the reward-seeking behavior that is a basic survival tool. Once a cue gains incentive salience, dopamine pushes us to pursue the object of our desire and doesn't readily allow us to be thrown off course. The pursuit of rewards tends to proceed to completion despite obstacles and distractions, commented Stephen Hyman, professor of neurobiology as well as provost at Harvard University. If I were heading up to my study to find a neuroanatomy paper, any distraction might derail my intention to go and read it. But if I'm going in pursuit of something rewarding, especially something intensely rewarding, I'll tend to complete the task. Over time, the pairing of a cue and a reward may intensify further. The association can increase in strength as a result of repeated experience or sensitization. A classic drug effect, sensitization is the mechanism by which the same dose of a drug produces a larger effect with repeated use. We can talk about the motivational power of cues if they're evoking something like incentive salience, said Berridge, and that can build over time, either through learning or if sensitization kicks in to magnify the cue-triggered neuronal process. In my conversation with Berridge, he theorized that only a subset of the population has heightened incentive salience, and that rewarding foods trigger overeating primarily in that group. Whether or not these people actually like the food more, Berridge suspects they will respond to the presence of food cues more intensely and are more likely to be overpowered by them. Schultz's monkeys and Corelli's rats, like Pavlov's dogs, have been conditioned to expect that a cue will be followed by a reward, and because of that learned association, they release dopamine in the presence of a cue. John Salamone and others have demonstrated that dopamine then leads us to eat rewarding foods, which in turn stimulates the pleasure-enhancing opioid circuitry. Putting together the various lines of study, we gain a fuller picture of the cycle. A cue triggers a dopamine-fueled urge. Dopamine leads us to food. Eating food leads to opioid release, and the production of both dopamine and opioids stimulates further eating. The cue stimulates arousal. We pursue the reward, and we experience release, and the arousal eases. Cues ensure that we will work hard to obtain the reward. That concept is well known in the food industry, where the most important goal of food design is to create anticipation.
Chapter 11. Emotions make food memorable.
Given the sensory power of sugar, fat, and salt, we might expect everyone to be drawn to much the same foods. But we're not, in part because our preferences are strongly influenced by what has happened to us in the past. A history of personal experience gives particular foods an emotional charge, and those emotions become lodged in our memory. Andrew, the journalist we met in the opening of this book, recalls being taken as a young boy to Carvel, the legendary ice cream chain in New York, to celebrate every Little League victory. The childhood memory still holds enough power that whenever he goes back to New York, his desire to head to Carvel battles with his determination not to do it. It takes his wife, whom he jokingly calls his AA sponsor, to hold him back. For me, it's chocolate-covered pretzels that have become imbued with emotional resonance. Walking past the hotel where I bought those pretzels years earlier jogs my memory of the pleasure associated with them and makes me want more. The circumstances that once surrounded the act of eating a rewarding food become the core of an emotional experience, and that feeling gets stored in working memory where it can be readily recalled. A cue triggers that recall, and recall stimulates desire. As those positive associations become ingrained, they can motivate our behavior even when we're not aware of them. Food becomes what Walter Mischel has called a hot stimulus, lighting up the emotional centers of the brain, getting us to think, feel, and respond to our desire. Memories interact with the reward pathways that drive our behavior. We can see the potency of memory and reward illustrated in a study in which subjects were shown pictures of various items, some linked to an opportunity to earn a monetary reward, and some not. Unsurprisingly, MRI scans showed that when people looked at pictures signaling a monetary reward, the dopamine-rich areas of their brains were activated. 3 weeks later, the researchers asked the same study participants what they remembered about the pictures, and discovered that participants had a significantly sharper memory of the pictures that predicted rewards. These results provide evidence for a relationship between activation of dopaminergic areas and long-term memory formation, wrote the study investigators. Or, in the arguably more poetic words of two Stanford scientists, reward circuits can whisper in the ear of memory circuits. One clear weekend afternoon, I drove across the Golden Gate Bridge and up to Sonoma County with Bill Schultz, a close friend visiting from the East Coast. We were on a quest for a restaurant where he had eaten a unique dessert 15 years before, a strawberry milkshake inside a chocolate bag. It was made by filling a paper bag with chocolate, then freezing it so it became a container for the shake. Both the presentation and the combination of tastes still loomed large in his mind, and we went from restaurant to restaurant, searching for the chef who had created the unforgettable concoction. When people conjure up a memory of a food that they really like a lot, and it's not available to them for some reason, they feel desire, said Marcia Pelchat, an expert in physiological psychology who works at Monell Chemical Senses Center. A memory of pleasure leads to desire. Bill remembered both the taste and the unique look of the milkshake, but it was the setting and his emotions at the time that intensified his longing. The day he encountered the dessert had been a special one. Nearing the end of an adventurous cross-country road trip, he was celebrating with an outdoor meal among friends in a California vineyard. Marriage was on his horizon. That sensory pleasure and personal history had become embedded in the idea of the milkshake, and Bill recalled it all in our afternoon's odyssey through Northern California in search of a taste and a memory. The power of such memories is undeniable. Ask people what they were doing on November 21st, 1963, or September 10th, 2001, and they're unlikely to recall. But mundane details about the days that followed are seared into the memories of most Americans alive at the time. This common experience is supported by a substantial body of research suggesting that we're better at remembering details when they're associated with emotionally charged events. That's the food industry's goal in its television advertising. We aren't being sold nutrition or satisfaction. We are being sold emotions. That's what the Applebee's campaigns, Eatin' Good in the Neighborhood, and The Flavors That Bring People Together are all about.
Chapter 12. Rewarding Foods Rewire the Brain.
In theory, there's a limit to how much stimulation rewarding foods can generate. The biological value of dopamine lies in its power to activate an animal's pursuit of food. When food is not immediately necessary, the brain is built to release less dopamine. We're supposed to habituate, to neuroadapt, by reducing the neural response that otherwise drives us toward a stimulus. That's part of the drive for balance. Homeostasis does not tolerate excesses, said Andras Hajnal, associate professor of neural and behavioral sciences at Pennsylvania State University. Sometimes that's indeed what happens, as a study by the Italian researcher Gaetano Di Chiara showed. When he first gave animals a cheese-flavored snack food called Fonzies, the levels of dopamine in their brains increased. Over time, habituation set in. Dopamine levels declined, and the food lost its capacity to activate their behavior. But there's more to the story. It turns out that if the stimulus is powerful enough, novel enough, or administered intermittently enough, the brain may not curb its dopamine response after all. Desire remains high. We see this with cocaine use, which does not result in habituation. A person who uses drugs of abuse will continue to release dopamine, generally at the same level as occurred with the initial use. Hyperpalatable foods alter the landscape of the brain in much the same way. I asked Di Chiara to study what happens after an animal is repeatedly exposed to a high-sugar, high-fat chocolate drink. When he'd completed his experiment, he sent me an email with "Important results" typed in the subject line. He had demonstrated that the dopamine response did not diminish after an animal was exposed to the chocolate drink for a prolonged period of time. There was no habituation. Novelty also impedes habituation. Dopamine levels remained elevated when the opportunity to feed on Fonzies was followed by access to chocolate. Habituating to one rewarding food does not habituate us to another. Intermittency is another driver. Give an animal enough sugar-laden food, withdraw that food for the right amount of time, and then provide it again in sufficient quantities, and dopamine levels may not diminish. Andras Hajnal and I decided to study the effect of both continued and intermittent exposure to a high-fat, high-sugar vanilla drink on the brain's dopamine system. When we exposed animals to the highly palatable food daily for 8 weeks, the brain was stimulated to keep on releasing dopamine. We saw no evidence of habituation. And when we limited exposure to just 2 days a week, the stimulating effect was even greater, with more dopamine being released. The trick to overcoming habituation, Hajnal told me, was to keep the food relevant to the animal. That can be achieved by offering a tantalizingly small amount of stimulating food, providing access to that food at the same, predictable time, or using other strategies that create a sense of anticipation. The effect is to undermine the brain's capacity to habituate to a persistent stimulus. There's still a lot we don't know about the relationship between the dopamine-driven motivational system and our behavior in the presence of rewarding foods. But we do know that foods high in sugar, fat, and salt are altering the biological circuitry of our brains. We have scientific techniques that demonstrate how highly rewarding and reinforcing foods and the cues associated with them change those circuits. Craig Schultz, who conducted research at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, has shown that there are shifts in what he calls the functional connectivity among important brain regions. After repeated exposure to stimuli and cues, the connections among the neural circuits change, and so do their response patterns. Rewarding foods are rewiring our brains. As they do, we become more sensitive to the cues that lead us to anticipate rewarding foods. In that self-perpetuating circularity lies a trap into which Sarah, Andrew, Samantha, and Claudia, whose stories began this book, have fallen. They cannot control their responses to highly palatable foods because their brains have been changed by the foods they eat.
Chapter 13. Eating behavior becomes a habit.
Habits develop when familiar stimuli activate well-established neural pathways that produce repetitive behavior. The same cues prompt us to react the same way. Over time, the act of eating highly rewarding food creates an automatic response. We build action schemata, mental imprints of the actions we take and the specific sequence in which we take them. Action schemata develop more quickly and become stronger when the stimulus driving our behavior is reinforcing. Once a script becomes imprinted in the brain, the behavior it dictates becomes so routine that we can respond before we're even conscious of a stimulus. A substantial body of scientific literature attests to this. Researchers have been able to measure movement before subjects know they're going to move. Brain activity stimulates a motor response in advance of awareness. I called Joshua Burke at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor to learn more about how repeat experience strengthens the circuits in the brain. He helped me understand the somewhat fuzzy but useful distinction between goal-directed and habit-driven behavior. An example of goal-directed behavior is the process of thinking about ice cream, desiring ice cream, and then taking deliberate steps to obtain ice cream. All of this involves a specific set of motivational neural circuits. If I walk into my house intent on taking a carton from the freezer, my activity is goal-directed and consciously reward-driven. I want that ice cream, and I'm going to act to obtain it. But if I do that often enough, the mental process changes. It becomes habit-driven behavior, less deliberate and more repetitive, and engages different neural circuitry. No longer motivated by a conscious desire for food, I head straight to the refrigerator when I get home because it's a habit. My motor behavior has become automatic. Dopamine influences both types of behavior, revving up the motivational circuits of the brain and strengthening the power of habit. The circuitry operates in roughly parallel loops, with one loop acting as the processing center for motivational information and another focusing on the motor activity associated with habits. The implications for someone trying to control food intake are obvious. As habits are learned, the brain, quote, comes to code whole sequences of behavior as performance units that can be triggered by specific contexts, explained science.